I'm William Shutkin.
And I'm Andy Bush.
Welcome to the Sustainable City Show, a new podcast where we discuss bold ideas and innovations for green, equitable, and climate-friendly cities with the people making them happen. Today, we're joined by renowned urban designer and planner, Peter Calthorpe, to discuss his big idea for making California and the rest of the nation more earth-friendly and affordable. He calls it Reinventing the Strip. Peter is co-founder of the Congress for the New Urbanism, senior vice president of HDR Calthorpe, and co-founder of the software firm Urban Footprint. He is the author of several books, including Sustainable Communities, The Next American Metropolis, The Regional City, Planning for the End of Sprawl, and Urbanism in the Age of Climate Change. Peter, welcome.
Thanks.
Andy?
Well, Peter, I've, as an urban planner by background, who's now been focused on sustainable development for 20 years, I followed your work from comprehensive planning to urban design to TOD-oriented planning process. And it seems like this is kind of the next logical extension. Can you give us some background and tell us what got you excited about it and kind of the overall premise for the concept?
Well, it's good to think about the background. The big background, of course, is the housing paradigm in the United States since World War II, which, of course, is ever more distant subdivisions. The notion of financial traction in this country has been built on single family home ownership. And we subsidized it after World War II with freeways and VA loans and redlining and zoning methodologies and standards that pretty much pushed everybody away from the city, away from walkable areas towards landscapes of asphalt in as far as the eye can see. I believe that that paradigm died in 2008, even though we were hacking away at its feet all the way back at the beginning of the 80s and the 70s with concepts of sustainability, with concepts of new urbanism, with concepts of transit-oriented development, a whole constellation of ideas, urban growth boundaries, things like that, all focused in on trying to shift the notion of what the good life was, or what was a really sustainable good life, away from that old automobile paradigm. But in 2008, which we tend to discount as a moment in time that had more to do with Wall Street and subprime mortgages, was really a manifestation of the fact that the product, the single family subdivision, was becoming less and less affordable to a workforce that had stagnant wages for 20 years, that were being asked to drive ever greater distances to get to work. As a matter of fact, one of the analyses we did way back when was, if you add the cost of transportation to the cost of housing, all of a sudden, the idea that travel till you qualify, the idea that, as long as you can build, keep building subdivisions way out in the middle of nowhere, they will inherently be affordable. Well, it's true, the land is less expensive, but the infrastructure is more expensive and the household costs are even more expensive. So I think 2008 was just a manifestation of the demise of that fundamental paradigm, how we house America. And it became too expensive for the environment. It became too expensive for the household. And you couldn't prop it up with enough magical thinking around financing. So since 2008, I actually think the country really hasn't resolved what the next step is. Hence, you have places like California, where our housing affordability has gone through the ceiling because we can't produce enough housing that's viable for the workforce. And I'm not talking about high-end housing for the ultra wealthy. I'm talking about workforce housing, which then impacts the inventory of affordable housing, which then impacts the people at the bottom of the ladder, pushing them right out onto the street in the form of homelessness. So California's got a housing deficit now of around 2.5 million units. It's just a frightening prospect. And we see it all the time. People talk about how people are leaving the state because it's, you know, the housing crisis is in place. And it's a housing crisis, it's an equity crisis, and it's an environmental crisis, all bundled together. So I actually came back to something that we did in the very first book I worked on, Sustainable Communities, where we looked at different different case studies for how to create really sustainable communities. We were trying to illustrate a very unmined or undeveloped concept of what sustainability really would be. And we certainly didn't think it was always about going off and creating a new town somewhere. And we didn't think it was about just reshaping the subdivision. So it was about infill, and it was about redevelopment, reusing assets, places that were deeply troubled. Well, fast forward, and we studied El Camino Real, which was a local, is a, you know, very famous street in the Bay Area. It runs from San Francisco to San Jose, right through the heart of Silicon Valley. And it's, of course, where the missionaries, it was their route for conquering this land, taking this land. So we looked at it then, and it occurred to me that it would be worthwhile to look at it now, because not only do we have this confluence in the last 10, 15 years of the demise of the single family model, or actually the demise of workforce housing, period, end of story, in most places, and also what we experienced with COVID, which was people staying at home, not going out on the strip to shop. And so all of a sudden, all that single story garbage that lined our arterials with aprons of parking lots, which were the place you would go to get what you needed, and that all started happening online. So not only was this a dysfunctional environment, because it was always congested and uglier than sin, because all that you could see was parking and signs, but also you basically had the economic foundation of that land use fall away. So I wondered, using our software, Urban Footprint, I could easily identify every parcel of land in the Bay Area that sat on a commercial strip and that was low density, i.e. parking and single story shops, which are underwater financially. And we identified all of them in the 5-county Bay Area. Turned out to be about 15,000 acres. The capacity, if you redevelop that land, is around 1.3 million units of housing. Now, the beauty of that strategy is that housing sits in the middle of the communities that are already mature. It runs through the heart of our major employment zones. And so it puts people closer to jobs, closer to mature services, closer to the kind of, I guess they call it the social capital of our communities, our regions. You know, there's so much written now about agglomeration economies, where whether you like it or not, whether you can spend your life staring at a computer screen, people still need to aggregate, and economies need to aggregate, and economic activity needs to aggregate. And quite frankly, workforce housing is most needed in those places because not everybody gets to work on a computer screen. We have a huge service economy now. So when you talk about school teachers, all the people who actually take care of our communities could no longer live there. Well, there it is. I could show you pictures, and it's always more compelling with pictures, but you can all imagine what the strip looks like today. It's the worst place in everybody's community. So and the Peter, question I asked is, what if the worst place became the best place? What if it became a grand boulevard with transit in the middle, wide sidewalks, bike lanes, plenty of trees, housing over shops? I don't think we'll ever get to the grandeur of Paris, but there's no reason these can't be really exciting, interesting places to live and a really important alternative. Now, I'm going to do this all in one soliloquy, so you're not even going to get to ask a question. So what if we were to build 1.3 million units of infill housing and stop building at the periphery of our regions? And by the way, we also did the analysis for LA County. That county alone has 19,000 acres of strip commercial, could accommodate 1.6 million units.
Amazing. And I was going to say, it isn't unique to the Bay Area that this kind of infill opportunity exists.
It's generic to the whole country. This was the paradigm, the strip, the subdivision, the mall, and the office park. Those are the building blocks. Creating, of course, a deadly environment. All right, so now you got all this potential housing. We did very detailed analysis on what the demand really was. And it turns out you can say everybody wants single family, but many people are in phases of life where single family is really not appropriate. Many people are economically strapped and just aren't going to get there. And so it turns out that multifamily from townhouse up, it fills about 80% of the market demand for workforce housing. There's still the elite. We're going to go off and get their estates, but that's just a whole nother discussion of social and economic equity. Mm-hmm. All right. So this fills the need and it puts it in the right place. How do you make it happen? Well, it turns out NIMBYism is still strong, and city by city, most cities, at least in California, really don't like housing because of our tax structure. Housing doesn't pay a lot of taxes, property tax, but it demands a lot of services. So city avoided like the plague. Existing homeowners hate it because it just means there's more people around to crowd things up. I think to make things more interesting, but they think to crowd things up. And so local opposition is always foremost, and these things just don't happen. Even if they're zoned into place, more often than not, local neighborhood groups would shout and yell enough to turn it into a 10-year ordeal just to get the permit.
Peter, we like to say in Boulder, there's no such thing as by right.
Yeah, well, that was the term I was about to use.
Nice.
This is a point in time where we cannot let local governments exclude workforce housing that needs to be infilled into their community. They've demonstrated they're not willing to do it, no matter how many carrots and sticks get thrown at them. And so we need state legislation that will create as of right zoning, minimum densities on strip commercial. The beauty of this is it doesn't touch any existing residential neighborhoods. Locals are against anything anywhere, but boy, are they against housing in their residential neighborhoods. And there's danger, quite frankly, whenever you rezone residential, that you're actually going to end up creating displacement and gentrification. So not such a good idea, and politically a much harder road. But we'll get to SB9 and the fact that we're trying that idea anyway, even though it may not be the most fruitful. So as of right means that every community has to allow this kind of housing to be built. I think the conditions on it, on the as of right, should be a fairly careful urban design code that goes with it. It says you're on a strip, but not all strips are created equal. Some are four lane, i.e. should be lower density. Some are near a major transit node, i.e. could be higher density. Some are six lane and could be converted with BRT, bus rapid transit, a good investment if we're bringing, if we're kind of infilling 1.5 million units, then you're going to need more transit. So that's a medium density. So the location will determine the various types of densities and also the adjacencies. If the back of the lot is single family, you need setbacks and height limits and things like that. It's all very easily doable. So you have a fairly precise, intelligent from an urban design standpoint, as of right law. The second thing you need is something and this is maybe get more complicated than your audience wants to get into, but the weeds are actually where the fertilizer gets made. And this is, you know, you don't get good growth unless you get deep into the weeds and churn it a bit. And that is tax increment financing. You guys know what that is?
Sure, we've done a lot of tax increment financing.
Okay, so but maybe the audience doesn't, so I'll explain.
Yeah,
tax increment was a tax strategy that was developed mainly around redevelopment agencies. So when we said that it's a blighted area, we have to redevelop it. One of the economic enhancements was, as it was redeveloping, it would generate higher property taxes. Those taxes would get recycled back into the project itself. Now, in California, that got thrown out some time ago, unfortunately. I would say that these ribbons of density should get tax increment, or the strip, the Grand Boulevard should get tax increment financing. What would it be used for? Number one, to subsidize affordable housing. Even though this housing type is intrinsically much more affordable than a subdivision, and even though the as of right would include a requirement for inclusionary, say 15%, that's on the developer. He got a piece of land on El Camino. He's building podium style apartments with ground floor shops, and he's doing all that stuff. It's not a heavy ask to say 15% of your units are affordable, but 15% is not enough. So one of the primary uses of the tax increment, which creates a stream of property tax, which then you can put a bond against and you get a lot of money. As a matter of fact, we calculated for the Bay Area, it's $43 billion of bonding capacity comes off these tax increments.
Hmm.
And with that, you can buy another 10% of affordable housing. So now you're at 25%. You can pay for BRT style transit on 400 miles of arterial in our city, 400 miles. All of a sudden, transit becomes so ubiquitous that people will actually use it. I mean, the big problem with transit in America is so infrequent that, you know, it's not near where you start, and it's not necessarily near where you end. But other than that, it's great. You know, you really need to make transit much more ubiquitous, and BRT is the way to do that. So the tax increment can pay for that. It can pay for making the street a beautiful place, adding the bike lanes, enhancing the sidewalks, putting in street trees, putting in transit. And then the third use for the $43 billion is to pay off the goddamn cities. So they would get funds out of the TIF to balance out what they claim, you know, I think, you know, to a lesser degree than they claim, but it's still real, that additional services are needed if you're bringing
impact
in that many people.
Yeah.
You know, that you've got to expand your park system, you got to enhance your police, you got fire, and there's infrastructure changes that has to happen. The point is that this is a strategy that not only puts housing in the right place and makes it affordable, but actually pays for itself and pays for expansion of our transit systems.
Yeah, and so, the beauty I see it, Peter, is that from a tax incremental financing standpoint, what you're really doing is freezing taxes, reinvesting that increment for a period of time, and then you get the benefit of that long term. You're not raising taxes on anyone as part of it, right?
No. In other words, if a developer buys that parcel, builds it, the value of that property goes up. Even in California, when the value goes up, you can adjust the tax. Prop 13 pretty much puts a cap of 1%, which is pretty low. By the way, you know, everybody says Texas is so affordable. You know what their property taxes are for residential?
No.
In Austin, 3%, 3%. So you go to Austin and everybody says, oh, the houses are so cheap. Yeah, just wait till you add in your property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
In California, it's 1%. So anyway, sidebar. Yes.
Where do you start, Peter? If you went into it, it's got to be, it seems like, well, I don't know, city by city, or do you pick the kind of ideal corridor and work on that? Or is it something we do en masse throughout the state as a legislative framework.
And Peter, let me just build on that, because you and I talked about this a little bit. I mean, is this a national campaign? Is it a Bay Area / California campaign with lawyers, advocates, lobbyists? Is it a demonstration project? And what generally is the scale of time, Peter, that we're talking? Let's say we were successful in promoting the concept, got real traction with the Scott Wieners of the world and Gavin Newsom's and Jared Polis's in Colorado, say. Are we talking roughly a kind of longer-term planning process of, say, a decade, decade and a half, where we will begin to see this kind of reinvestment and strategy unfold?
You know, I think that, I maybe left out one of my books. It was called The Regional City, and it was about regional planning. I'm a big believer in regional plans. Now, for grand boulevards, I think we need state legislation, because the local jurisdictions not only control their own zoning, but they control the regional planning agencies.
Yeah.
But actually, this thing could be adopted region by region. So in other words, the kind of taxonomy of housing that we would put into Bay Area grand boulevards would probably be different than Fresno or Sacramento or some other places. And so, sure, you know, in its most beautiful form, it would be a regional as of right, which would mean every city would have to allow this housing in the region. But it might be a different set of design standards, region by region.
And in California, it could be overlaid essentially on the housing allocation model, which is essentially a regional model with the participation of regional councils of government, et cetera.
Yeah. For example, right now, there are three kind of, this is not a experiment. This is a proven viable strategy. So years ago, I rezoned University Avenue, which is the main gateway to Berkeley, you know, the university, one of the most, you know, amazing places on the planet. And you drove through motels and gas stations and strip commercial to get there. So, you know, and it was the street with the highest crime rate in all of Berkeley. So we rezoned it for 4-story maximum housing over shops. And lo and behold, it's all pretty well built out and all the crime is gone from that street. It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. Redwood City and Mountain View, enlightened cities in Silicon Valley on El Camino, have done the same. They zone it, it gets built right away because the market demand is there and developers are very comfortable with this housing strategy. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not a bizarre new mix. They can do it. The banks are comfortable with it. You know, so the moment the zoning is there, the buildings will start. And so I think the as of right, I'd like to see it at the state level. The state may be too timid, so they may say, we'll do as of right for LA and San Francisco, Bay Area, and the coastal cities where our crisis of jobs, housing imbalance is greatest, where the affordable housing is really in trouble, and homelessness too. Mm-hmm. You know, there may be a piece of state legislation that says as of right for these MPOs, regional planning organizations. That would be a decent way to start, and politically it may have legs. Now, we ought to talk about the fact that we did just pass a law, SB9, which as of right makes every single family lot something you can split into two, and then each of the two has had for some time an ADU law, which allows an ADU. Now, I love ADUs. I think that's a beautiful concept all day and all night. People can build it. It's not that expensive to build. They're small, da, 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 da. But to do a lot split and to develop three more units on your house, I think is the kind of thing that unfortunately is only gonna happen in wealthy neighborhoods where households can have the wherewithal to get the financing and organize the contractors and go through all the stuff, because it's never that simple. Each one will be a one-off. I think, unfortunately, the results will be anemic in terms of quantity of housing. Mm-hmm. It will benefit. I mean, if the people who are advocating that law were really trying to take on the economic equity in the misplaced economic equity in single family housing for so long.
Forget about it.
They just enhanced.
Yeah.
You know, everybody who's fortunate enough to own a big lot somewhere, lot that's big enough to split, they're the guys who are going to make money.
Well,
they're
part of what made it palpable, right? And sellable. You're adding value.
I never thought that, you know, that's a very cynical thought, but I never thought that because it was being led by people who were truly.
Yeah, you and Doug Farr and the CNU for 30 years have been advocating ADUs before anybody knew what one was. It was like,
I think ADUs are fine. And you know, you can imagine them fitting on small lots. You know,
but they are expensive. The other thing I worried about, you have to permit them. You've got to hire contractors and consultants. Where Andy and I have had this conversation many times. It's no simple feat to make a building appear in your backyard. It takes a lot of hoops and a lot of cash.
Well, it probably happens in high-end neighborhoods with large lots. And in those places, you know, and then the results will be incredibly expensive.
So, and oftentimes they turn into VRBO rental units and stuff. I'm not sure it's a great way to get housing when you have, you know, kind of back to the strip, most of the infrastructure is in place. The retail that stays will be an evolutionary process. And you've got a great kind of transit corridor or corridors to develop transit on, it almost seems like kind of the ultimate no-brainer.
Well, and Peter, to add to that, Connor Doherty, you and I have talked about Connor of the New York Times, was with me and Andy a couple of months ago and talked about these sort of unregulated organic ADUs that one sees throughout the coastal cities of California, which have this sort of interesting history where it is in fact a way of providing friends and family affordable housing. And as soon as you formalize the process and add the regulatory overlays and the other compliance requirements, that's when you start to see the economics come into play, where that homeowner who developed the ADU in a formal sense now really needs to recoup that investment. And it becomes less about, you know, giving the brother or sister a hand. And it's more about, hey, now I've got to really bone up and become essentially a business person operating an accommodation.
Yeah. The only other fear I have, and they at the last minute, they changed the law so that the owner had to live there. Because I was very frightened that low income neighborhoods like West Oakland or East Palo Alto, small lots, developers would just descend on them, buying lots, splitting them and turning them into, you know, techie condo, tiny
house,
which actually is not serving. The other thing I think about Grand Boulevards is you're dealing with workforce housing, high-end single techies who can afford, there are a couple rungs on the economic ladder up. They would move into West Oakland. They already are. That gentrification is happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, the danger is if they hadn't put in that stipulation of owner occupied, I would have just seen West Oakland be clear cut. Not to mention East Palo Alto, the heart of Silicon Valley. I mean, it would just be overnight gentrified. So they did a good thing by adding that stipulation. Still unclear whether developers are going to go in and offer low-income households, we'll save your house and we'll do a lot split and build something in your backyard. And, we'll give you $80,000 and you won't have to move. And then, wait a minute, what is that going to end up like? Mm-hmm. You know, so there's all sorts of question marks. Mm-hmm. I just hope the good thing about it is that finally, the state of California said, we're going to use a powerful tool called as-of-right zoning. We're not going to let local jurisdictions have ultimate control. And, you know, by the way, New York has always been as-of-right, and it's a beautiful thing. It makes, here's another anecdote, it makes transfer development rights really functional. So every parcel of land in New York has as-of-right. They don't have to go through community hearings or design review committees. They don't get appealed up to city council, none of that. If they build as of right, they build as of right. They take it to the building department, their working drones. Now, if they want to go denser, they can buy development rights from somebody else. Because the moment you've created an as-of-right domain, not everybody wants to use it, right? And sure. So there's value on other people's property that maybe they don't want to mine. But somebody can buy it, it happens all the time, and then they have to go through a more stringent design review. But it does enhance the viability of transfer development rights, which I think is another component of solving the housing crisis.
But gosh, Peter, I mean, my daughter lives in Crown Heights in Brooklyn and is paying $1,600 for one room in a 4-bedroom walk-up apartment in a slowly but surely gentrifying neighborhood of Brooklyn. And as progressive as New York City's zoning and housing policy has been over the years, whether it's the corruption or just the fact that there's so much money in play in the Big Apple, you know, I would be reluctant to look to it as a model of moving this agenda forward, especially the last decade or so. And, you know, the rise of the pencil super towers, et cetera.
You know, I want to put this into, you know, I'm supposed to be a liberal hippie who doesn't believe in market economies, but sometimes the market economy gets so out of whack that you've got to believe in it.
Okay.
So yeah. Since 2010 to 2018 in the Bay Area, we created 880,000 jobs and just over 116,000 housing units, 116.
Crazy.
Yeah, so the imbalance is, I mean, it's pretty clear why everything that actually exists is very expensive. There's a huge deficit. Now, just to put that, the number for the 5-county strip only, doesn't touch any other ground, strip only development was 1.3 million. That's 10 times, more than 10 times what we accomplished in that period of time. So all of a sudden really honestly believe that if you enhance the supply to that level, that you will see the median price go down and you'll create a lot more entry level housing.
Which includes that 15% inclusionary, which is
25%.
Or 25, right, with the TIF.
15% from the developer, 10% from the TIF.
Yeah.
And Peter, did you see the same formula or framework in LA County when you looked at that?
Yeah, we looked at, you know, the other thing we did was we used urban footprint because urban footprint can make it very easy to measure all sorts of impacts of housing. So in the Bay Area, and I'm not going to be able to remember all the numbers, but in the Bay Area, we compared the Grand Boulevard housing to what could be another growth in the Far East Bay, over the hill, and in the kind of more suburban parts of the region, Livermore and out there, Walnut Creek and Concord, these suburban communities.
Danville, yeah.
And the environmental, the VMT went down by over 50% per household, carbon emissions over 50%, water consumption over 50%. I'll send you the numbers, you know, and household costs. Now, let's go full circle.
Yeah.
You get a more affordable unit in a Grand Boulevard, but you're spending less money and you're spending less money on transportation and commuting. And you're spending less money on on utilities, because of course a party wall is an efficient way of saving BTUs. So, you know, you look at it environmentally, you look at it socially, you look at it in terms of the nature of community. It wins in all ways. The final thing is that I would think the local cities would wake up to the fact that getting the eyesore of the strip commercial out of their town and turning it into the place where the hippest restaurants end up and there's some street life, some real street vitality, and new transit in your town, maybe they grow up and understand that this is actually would be an enhancement.
I think they would. Andy, you know that our friend Jim Kunstler, Peter, has called Boulder's 28th Street, which is our main artery.
Oh yeah.
36.
It's a perfect poster child.
Jim has called that worse than the Newark Airport frontage road. That's Boulder's.
Well, it's so ironic because Boulder has such a holy reputation of Enviro and of course Pearl Street is a beautiful place to walk. And, you know, it's easier to get pedestrians movement in towns that are filled with college kids, by the way.
It is.
Yeah, that's true. Towns
are pretty awesome. Boy, does Boulder fall down when it gets out there to, what is that road down there, 28th?
It's 28th.
Yeah. State Highway 36.
And yeah, Peter, if you were advising the mayor of Boulder or a progressive mayor in Southern California or Northern California who said, all right, I buy it, let's get started. I'm not going to wait for the state. I'd love to participate regionally. How would you tell them to get going?
Simple. Just take all the strip commercial land and zone it for mixed use and then let the private sector do the rest.
Nice.
You know, it's not that difficult. You know, if it doesn't work, if there's a super viable retail establishment, and let's not forget that there are land leases that are in place that have tenure. You know, not everything's going to happen instantly, but over time, you know, some of the most opportunistic sites will redevelop very quickly. They'd still have shops.
Yeah.
And then over time, people would see the value of it. Property owners would see the value of it, and they would not renew the leases that basically enable parking lots.
Yeah.
A place as valuable as Boulder, it's like Silicon Valley, those places can afford to put in a few parking structures and free up land for mixed use. So you might get these weird hybrids where you have some housing and some traditional shopping venues. Hey, I forgot to talk about the most exciting part of the whole idea, because I kept talking about BRT, bus rapid transit.
Yeah,
that's old technology. I think we have a new generation of transit on the way. I call it autonomous rapid transit. So if you think of exactly the same bus lanes that BRT run in, and of course you have to have dedicated protected lanes to make people feel like they're going to skip through traffic and not have to bury themselves behind automobiles all the time. So you have to get the dedicated lanes in place. And normally you put buses. The buses stop at every station, so they're kind of slow, even if they get past the traffic. Now imagine putting autonomous vans in these dedicated right-of-ways and having an algorithm that allows you to pick a van that takes you direct to your destination. Because there are lots of them running and some of them are going here. So every trip would be an express trip. We did an analysis of a new BRT system in San Francisco on Gary Boulevard. And the ART, Autonomous Rapid Transit concept, reduced operations and maintenance by 50%. So much cheaper to run. And increased the average rider trip speed 27%. Because there's no interim stops. Also immediately all electric. It's a better way to use all the money being spent on autonomy, because if autonomous vehicles turn out to be private vehicles or even Uber, you're going to anywhere from increase of 30% to a doubling in BMT because of all the deadhead wandering around stuff that's going to happen and longer commutes. I mean, the outcome for autonomy will be really negative on cities unless we turn it into the next generation of transit.
Yeah.
So the cool thing is you can start with BRT. Permits for autonomous vehicles are more likely sooner if they're in dedicated protected lanes. Because I think that there's also endless question marks about liability in mixed flow environments. So it means that technology could come online sooner and would really make a huge difference. BRT is already the cheapest to build, but autonomous rapid transit would be even cheaper because you wouldn't pay drivers, which are typically beyond 50% of fare box.
Well, and it's at a time where machine learning and reinforced machine learning, the kind of things that say, how do we understand where someone wants to go now? And how do we group and gather and organize those behaviors? if we can do that combined with autonomous vehicles, I think you're right. There's some real confluence technology that's coming along at this point in time.
Anyway, you heard it here. New concept. Autonomous rapid transit, ART, not BRT.
No, that's
and
awesome.
And that's for all the Grand Boulevards.
That's awesome.
But I got to go, guys.
Yeah, you got to go. You were so great to spend time with us. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you
great,
so much.
Great Bye. To see you. Okay, see you soon.
Take care.
In our next episode, we look at sustainability, health, and wellness in buildings and real estate with Brad Jacobson, principal at EHDD, a San Francisco-based architecture firm, and Elena Ladner, who heads the sustainability practice at Jones Lang LaSalle's Project and Development Services in the West.